What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to AmericaTrendsPodcast.com, another episode that I know you're going to want to tell your friends about, you're going to want to listen to time and again, and John Krofcik is with me. I'm Larry Rifkin, of course, and we love doing this for you.
How goes the battle?
All right. How are you?
Good.
All right. Well, here we are, and we're recording this in the dog days of summer, and it's wonderful. I mean, it really is. But, John, we want to go back, in a sense, to the 2016 campaign. Or do we want to go back to the 2016 campaign?
But no, I guess we should for this episode.
Well, just briefly. And John, if you recall, during the campaign, there was this one clarion call that got Trump supporters their hearts pumping, pounding.
Yes.
At every rally,
right?
When he was having a tough time, when the night wasn't going the way that he wanted to exhort the crowds to a state of frenzy, it was his stock in trade.
Yeah, I remember that.
You remember?
Yeah.
Well, it was like Bruce Springsteen having a tough night and saying to himself, hey, guys in the E Street Band, let's turn it on. Born to Run. Now. Let's do it. Or like Bill Cosby. Can I mention his name?
I don't know if you should.
No? Well, if he was bombing on his stand-ups, you know, the things he used to do, and he'd return to the Fat Albert routine. And that would win. Yeah, that would always win. So this is the same thing. Donald Trump, hey, look, he's a showman. That's where it starts.
He's definitely a showman.
Yep. May end. I'd like to see him go from showman to statesman, but not quite there yet.
Well,
but
we'll see how he does at the G20 there.
Yeah, we'll see. But his winning line was, and we're going to build a wall, and Mexico is going to pay for it.
Exactly.
Remember?
Yes.
He would throw that in anytime, any place, anywhere, and he would get these incredible responses.
Frenzy. It was like the Beatles entered the room.
Yeah. So this was one he knew that when things weren't going quite right, just pour it on. So how is that all working? Well, first of all, have you seen any signs that the border wall itself, I mean, as a construct, is being built?
You know, not to my knowledge, we haven't heard anything about the wall. Initially, when he got in, he spoke about the wall a lot still. But
in fact, I hear more people talking about the wall when it comes to, you know, that great album of many years ago, The Wall.
Another brick in the wall.
I mean, so that wall I still hear about because it's one of the greatest albums of all time. But I don't hear a lot about this wall. And honestly, Mexico doesn't seem to want to pay for it. There is this new idea that I know Donald Trump has put forward about solar panels.
Right.
And the
right.
wall.
Yes.
But that would only pay for it, I think, over a period of about 20 years. But one thing that really didn't happen, and Hillary Clinton didn't push it, and he didn't really explain it, is there a better way for us to go about our relations with Mexico than putting up this permanent barrier, given the fact that there are so many ties economically and culturally in the Southwest? I mean, that used to be Mexico's land, after all.
Right.
So the question is, nobody really said, can't we think of different ways that we can make ourselves safe, really have a system that works in terms of immigration without building a wall that has all kinds of problems perhaps attendant to it?
Well, I think you're right. I think we need to have that conversation because, I mean, we do have trouble with drugs coming over the wall, I mean, coming over the border, and stuff that we don't want here in this country. So, but is the wall the answer? I don't know.
Well, one thing that I think a lot of people don't realize, John, and you and I mean, we were certainly made well aware of this, is the fact that already of that border, which is almost 2,000 miles, we already have an element of a wall or a barrier or a membrane along 700 miles.
I was surprised to learn this because I didn't even know we already had a wall. That's what was the most eye-opening about this.
Well, it just wouldn't have had the same resonance on the campaign circuit if he said, we're going to build the rest of that wall. You know, I mean, really, the rest of the wall doesn't sound like.
But judging from what's going on with the wall that's there, it's not working very well.
No. And there are some other creative ways that we can look at our relationship with Mexico. Hey, look, let's be honest about it. Already, just his exhortations about immigration and making certain people feel unwelcome. And because perhaps there's more work down there and less work up here, whatever the dynamics are, fewer people are trying to come across. And that has been the case for many years now.
Well, and also I think I think big corporations and stuff are a part of that. They're bringing people over to work cheaply. I mean, they're really the modern day slaves of the 21st century. Really, you think about it.
Exactly. And look, there was that whole idea of let's expel them or exploit them.
Right.
And I mean, it's wrong. It's wrong.
It is
and our
wrong.
Policy stinks. And the federal government over the years has done a horrible job of managing immigration policy. So I would agree with him that we should have a coherent and an enforceable policy. But the wall, well, that is a bridge too far for me, at least. So when you look at the Southwest again, I mean, culturally and economically, our relations with Mexico are really important, I think, to both countries.
I think so, too. I think, you know, they're our neighbor on the South there. We should have good relations with them, just like we should have with Canada. I mean,
now, wait a minute. Now you're talking to Canadians. I don't know.
They already think they're Americans.
No, they give us the cold shoulder up there. Well, we want to introduce you to architecture professor Ronald Rayel. And he teaches at Berkeley. And he's got some really interesting and rather unconventional ways of looking at all of this. First, he is opposed to a wall. And we want to make that clear from the outset. But he offers some incredible ways to allow the cultures to intersect rather than cutting themselves off from each other. And I really think he's worth a listen. He really is.
Oh, I think so, too. I think any ideas that we can get to make life better between the two countries, we need to search out.
And I'm telling you, John, as you know, you're going to hear some things from the professor that you have never heard before. And some of the cultural exchanges that already have gone on across that 700 miles of barrier that's already been erected, and some of the ideas that he has to really make this an engaging place. And, you know, aside from just the cultural imperative of not building one of these structures, I mean, the last time we talked about walls politically was when we were applauding and cheering when one came down in East Europe.
The Berlin
so
Wall.
Why? Why are we talking about building them? But having said that, there are a lot of ecological problems that I don't think we think about. There are a lot of problems that the land would face and the people and the birds and the wildlife. There are so many facets to this. And sometimes I really regret that in America, we often don't get below the surface on some of these issues to ask ourselves the very hard questions.
Well, let's get him on because we need ideas.
All right. Well, here he is, Professor Rayel.
Ronald Rayel is joining us now on America Trends podcast. He's an associate professor of architecture at Berkeley. He's written an incredibly interesting book and had a lot of collaboration. It's called Border Wall as Architecture, a manifesto for the U.S.-Mexico boundary. And let me just read one of the contributors at the opening of this book. Fascinated with the walls we build, I spent much of the last few years traveling along some of the world's most fortified borders. I walked along the barricades that stand between India and Bangladesh, Israel and Palestine, and northern and southern Cyprus. I toured the misnamed peace lines of Belfast and the refugee camps on the wrong side of Morocco's sand wall in the West Sahara. Each walled place possesses its own brand of injustice and absurdity, but nowhere did the barricades evoke as much sadness as along America's border with Mexico. And nowhere else did the borderlands feel so sacred. America's southern frontier is a kind of holy land. Explain what he was trying to say, one of your contributors in this book.
I think the our southern frontier evokes this kind of sacred nature for a number of reasons. And I think fundamental to that is that this is a place of great loss. There are countless deaths of people traveling through the desert and driving themselves to dehydration, and the wall serves as a barrier to that migration. And of course, then one could say is the wall is complicit in those deaths. And so it's a place of great sadness. And I think desert lands are often places where one seeks out that sort of sacred and spiritual quality in terms of environment. And so it evokes both of those sort of phenomena, I would say. But it's also a place where people celebrate a binational identity that attempts to be divided by a line in the sand. And I think that when you contribute, when you combine a very special landscape with moments where we confront both death and a coming together, that evokes a kind of sense of sacredness.
Is there ever an appropriate time, you as an architect, to build a wall, to separate people from each other? Do you see that as being a legitimate form of architecture at any point in time?
Well, there's a very famous architect whose name was Hassan Fathi. He was an Egyptian architect. And one of his famous quotes was that architects do not design walls. They design the spaces between them. And I think what the construction of this wall has produced is a series of spaces that call into question the nature of the wall itself. It, as a barrier, has produced spaces that divide people, as we've mentioned, that divide ecologies, wildlife, private properties, public lands. And so certainly I think that we have to, as architects working in the field of making walls, of making barriers, whether we're designing a house or a restaurant or what have you, it's important not to understand the wall itself. Are we taking into consideration the consequences of the wall? I think that's the most important question. And I think that, like the wall itself, there are unfortunately two sides or two answers to that question. Some say yes and some say no. I'm certainly on the side that says that we have to be careful about the spaces that we make with the walls that we construct. And I think there's an unfortunate reality to the construction of this wall. At the same time, and this is why I wrote the book, I think that there's a remarkable resilience to the environment and to the people who occupy the landscape around the wall and the way they negotiate it and confront it and deal with it on a daily basis is very surprising and in some cases very uplifting.
Well, Ronald, I think there are a lot of people listening who may not even know that already there are more than 700 miles of fence, steel, and cement running along about a third of the border. So you certainly have a glimpse into what the entire wall or some kind of barrier or boundary might look like. What's going on along those 700 miles?
Well, this is one of the reasons that I wrote the book, in fact, that I also thought that people really don't know that there are 700 miles of wall already in place. So when our current president during the campaign would announce, "I'm going to build a wall," and audiences would cheer, it became very surprising to me, as if someone has finally arrived who's going to build a wall. But in fact, there's a great ignorance about the wall that exists. And so the book is really about 700 miles of these stories about this wall constructed of steel and concrete and Vietnam-era repurposed landing mats, barbed wire fence, and how it affects the landscape that it divides. And so there are many stories. The stories are sometimes very personal, and they're about human interaction with the wall itself. And sometimes they're at a much larger scale and talk about how the wall is dividing various regions. And I can give you some examples.
Yeah, I do want to get to that. I do want to say, though, that when we think of a wall, the last evidence politically of a wall was the Berlin Wall. And when that came down, we were so excited. We were so thrilled that there was this permeability that, in fact, we were going to be able to share democratic ideals across that area now, which we hadn't for years. I mean, that was exciting. So the one wall that has had a political impact of great enormity in the recent period was one coming down.
Exactly. And so when Ronald Reagan called on to Gorbachev to tear down this wall, I mean, this marked a moment of moving into an era of globalization and exchange and democracy and freedom across these kinds of political boundaries. And so that, in many ways, is what's disappointing about the nature of the desire for walls, because it returns us to a pre-Cold War era, thinking about a kind of nationalism that is locked behind a steel wall, rather than participating in a 21st century culture that is really about exchange and sharing, especially between a country that is not our enemy and that we have a very deep symbiotic and cultural and historical relationship with.
Absolutely. It's interesting because now President Trump, feeling that perhaps Mexico is not going to pay for the wall, is talking about doing something relatively creative along the wall, and that is to put solar panels along it. You have many fanciful ideas, and some of which are born out of the 700 miles that we will talk about. But it's very interesting to see that he's now looking for a practical use that might restore energy to the area and benefit the people there.
Right, and the book arrives at a very interesting point in history when there's a president who is seeking ideas about a wall, but the book is really about the 700 miles of wall that are already in place. So the creative propositions that I put forward in this book are really about how do we address the existing wall and how can we fix the landscape that the wall damages in a number of ways. Again, I talk about many, many stories about how the wall has transformed these landscapes, and suggestions or speculations or really hyperboles in some cases about what could be done. So when, and one of those speculations is about rethinking investment in the borderland. So in my book, I do talk about the possibility to introduce photovoltaic solar energy in the U.S. Mexico borderland region, because this is one of the most prime regions in the United States for solar energy production. So I think the issue I have with Donald Trump's proposal is that rather than thinking about investment in solar energy, he's thinking about how am I going to pay for a new wall since I can't get Mexico to pay for it. And so therein lies the problems with that proposition.
You have said that building a wall to keep determined people out of any place is simply ineffective. If they want in, they'll manage cross the border no matter how tall, wide, or strong the wall is. Is there evidence of this even along the 700 miles?
Oh, absolutely. And that's something that's widely recognized by the Department of Homeland Security and Border Patrol. The wall that's put in place in those 700 miles is really a five-minute speed bump in the desert, and Homeland Security acknowledges that. It delays someone crossing in the desert 5 minutes. And so it doesn't stop them, doesn't prevent that from happening, and people cross in really remarkable, ingenious ways. There's the famous quote, show me a 20-foot high wall, and I'll show you a 20-foot, 21-foot ladder. People climb the wall, they will tunnel underneath the wall, they cut the wall open, and this happens on a daily basis. So the wall is a construction that's constantly being dismantled and constantly being repaired on a daily basis.
When you do have one of the richest countries bordering one of the poorest countries, what results from that, particularly when you're trying to stem the tide from the poorer to the richer region?
Well, I don't necessarily see it as that being kind of the most important question to suss out, the adjacency between a very wealthy country and a country that's less wealthy, because I think there exists a kind of cultural richness and historical richness that is shared between both countries. I think that the borderlands, in fact, are this sort of in-between world, and one of my colleagues, Michael Deere, calls this a third nation, where we actually see that there's not a here or there, but that language, cuisine, history, culture, family relationships, landscapes, these are all shared in a gradient across that zone. So to attempt to create a synthetic division between those worlds in some ways is simply impossible. People on a daily basis cross that border to come to school in the United States, to go to just tourist into Mexico, and this happens on a daily basis through that barrier. So I think, again, we are involved in a scenario where we are building a wall as a symbol, and it has unfortunate consequences as a symbol, because symbology results in very different meaning for very different people. In some cases, the wall is seen as a symbol of security, and it's very arguable that it operates efficiently as a secure device. But it also symbolizes xenophobia and racism, and so these are, I think, some of the consequences of this type of construction that we have to contend with.
And I thank you for adding to the fact that it's a rich country and a poor country. There are all of these cultural ties, as you reference, and then there is this commerce between the United States and Mexico that plays itself out legally, illegally, in so many ways. I found it interesting that during the campaign, I think Donald Trump would say, and I'll build a wall, and he would say that at any point where he thought his speech might be lagging. And it was really a very clear but very simple message, not one that had any subtlety to it. I think everybody understood what he was trying to say. And yet when I read in your book about the walls that are found along the southern border of the U.S., because I think a lot of people, when they heard him, they imagined a big old wall. And he would say that, a big, beautiful wall. But you tell us that the various typologies, as you call them, of walls, pedestrian, vehicular, bollard, hybrid, levee, natural, virtual, landmat, anti-ram, floating, DIY, that there are so many different forms of whatever you want to call this, border and boundary. That I don't think we understand exactly even what the 700 miles we're talking about today really represents.
Right. Well, those 700 miles are approximately one-third of the entire border between the United States and Mexico. So that's an enormous section of landscape that's already been walled off, and this has been ongoing for decades. And it's a very difficult proposition to imagine making that border impermeable. It's literally impossible. Water has to cross. So in one section of construction near Tijuana, there was a canyon called Smuggler's Gulch. And they basically raised the top of a mountain, excavated the top of the mountain and filled in the canyon to make a barrier. It's one of the most expensive sections of attempting to construct a wall, in this case, a massive earthen dam to divide Mexico from the United States in this canyon. But at the very bottom of the canyon, of course, is an enormous opening to allow water to pass through. And myself and some colleagues actually hosted an event. This is the architect Teddy Cruz, who writes the foreword to the book. He hosted an event that took people on a journey into Mexico through that culvert. And so, again, it's impossible to demand a kind of impermeability on the border, because water, animals, culture, life, you cannot stop the kind of diversity in terms of, again, life and culture and technology that needs to cross this border on a daily basis.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is such a rich area, as you say, and canyons and culverts and gullies and mountains. I mean, it is remarkable. And then what are the impacts ecologically on any of these designs?
Well, certainly I could go through the gamut. Let's start with water drainage. Something as simple as a rainstorm, for example. So when several sections of the wall were constructed, they didn't take into account something as simple as a rainstorm. So one day during a rainstorm, the water that would typically flow across the border suddenly hits this enormous wall and has nowhere to go but perpendicular to the wall, traveling all the way into a city and flooding the city on both sides. In other cases, the water has no place to go again. It builds up with water and debris and knocks down the wall. And this has happened several times. And so there are consequences to these kinds of constructions, not only in terms of the ecology, but also the wildlife. There are birds who do not fly, in some cases, higher than the wall is constructed. And so this prohibits birds from taking their natural migratory paths. The same is true for animals that are grazing or in search of water, or in search of their natural breeding ground. So scientists are beginning to recognize that the genetic diversity of animals on both sides are beginning to decrease because of the construction of the wall. The list goes on and on. I mean, walls, many sections of the walls are illuminated all night long with stadium lights, which confuses nocturnal animals because it's illuminated 24 hours a day. And so, I mean, I could go on and on, and many of these stories are told in the book.
Ronald Rael is with us. The book is called Border Wall as Architecture, a Manifesto for the U.S.-Mexico Boundary. He's an associate professor of architecture at Berkeley, and certainly not a fan of the wall, but he basically is arguing that if we're going to have something like this, there might be some ways that at least we can make this more palatable and, in fact, try to draw people together rather than to separate them. You say, of course, that there have been many things along this 700-mile wall that suggest that human beings already have gotten very creative as to ways that they are going to perhaps surmount the limits of the wall. Tell us what they have done in various cases, including things like a horse race and, of course, the xylophone incident in 2014, and then we can get into some of the design ideas that you have.
Sure, and I want to back up for 1 second and just point out that I'm not in favor of new construction of the wall. Again, this is really a book about the approximately 700 miles of wall that are already in place and how we might address that existing landscape. So by no means are these designs for a new wall, but they're suggestions about what we can do alongside the existing wall or onto the wall, or ways that we can dismantle the wall that exists in order to improve those landscapes and the lives of people who live in those regions. So I just want to make that clear.
Right.
Because my belief is that we should invest in the borderlands because these are some of the fastest growing regions in the United States. And as you pointed out earlier, some of the poorest regions, both not only in Mexico, but in the United States as well. And so there is a necessity for investment in these places, but I don't believe that investment in a wall is a way to promote safety and security necessarily, because I am a proponent of safety and security. But if you could imagine promoting the construction of libraries or schools or clinics or clean water or clean energy, this would be a good direction to promote security in the United States and in Mexico. And so many of the drawings that I've produced and models that I've produced for this book take into account lessons learned from those 700 miles. And so you mentioned the xylophone wall, for example. So again, the idea here isn't that Donald Trump should construct xylophones, but the lesson is that there are stories and lessons to be learned. For example, there's a really interesting artist named Glenn Wayant in Arizona, and he plays the border wall as an instrument, as an act of activism through his art. And so he will pound on the wall as a percussive instrument, and he will actually play the wall like a stringed instrument with a bow and record them and create these kind of sonic landscapes. But what I think he's really doing is he is slowly dismantling the wall by first dismantling the meaning of the wall and dismantling the psychology that the wall engenders as a power structure or as a structure of power. And so the xylophone wall drawing really kind of memorializes these acts and remembers them as these moments when someone went out and played the wall as a musical instrument, therefore changing the meaning of it from a militaristic structure into a xylophone. And so this is why I call these drawings and these models recuerdos. That means memories, and it means souvenirs. And so these are really moments that we remember how in this walled world that we have created, people are acting against it, and it becomes a way that people have come together. You mentioned the horse race as well. There's this very beautiful and famous horse race that took place, one between a horse in the United States and a horse in Mexico. And both of these horses were revered, and the communities on both sides of the border wanted to pit these two horses together to see who would win, they were unable to bring the horse into Mexico or bring a horse into the United States because of hoof and mouth disease, and there was a regulation against that. So they decided to pit the horses alongside the wall, one horse running in Mexico and one horse in the United States, and the crowds came on both sides and cheered for the horses, and they raced down the wall. And so this was a moment of celebrating binational identities, a connection between two countries that was very really beautiful and adds to the rich history of this region. And so what I love about that, again, is that the wall is becoming an attractor. Again, it's not a militaristic device, but people doing the kinds of things they do every day in celebration begin to conceptually dismantle the wall. And so I think that is a remarkable phenomenon when people can come together through art and celebration and design and see those as valid forms of activism. And I think...
And you have been inspired, and beautifully so, and in some subversive ways, which I think is wonderful, by virtue of what has happened in the past. And I just want to give people an inkling, and I want them to go and get the book, Border Wall as Architecture. But I want to give them a couple of the ideas that you have floated here. For example, a fog wall. And you say the fog is a serious impediment for Border Patrol agents when it blankets the region. Explain what you're suggesting here.
Well, in this case, right, you point out that when the fog descends, that this allows people to cross the wall without being seen by Border Patrol agents. But I'm suggesting, well, there's an enormous infrastructure of steel that's put in place with alongside communities that don't have access to clean water. Can we build upon that infrastructure that already exists and transform it in very much the same ways that the musician has transformed the wall into an instrument, into a fog catcher that collects water and distributes water to communities along the border, thus again dismantling it.
Right, for the purpose that some hold for it and take it in another direction to sustain life. What about the cactus wall?
Well, the cactus wall, I think, again, speaks to the ironies and complexity of the wall. And so where it's very controversial when I say, well, let's build upon the infrastructure that's already in place, because that suggests to some that, oh, I condone the wall because I'm not suggesting its complete dismantlement. I'm suggesting that, in fact, let's utilize the material that already exists in place. In the case of the cactus wall, I'm suggesting a dismantling of the wall. But I'm suggesting of the dismantling of the wall within a wilderness that is what I would call a site that is a national treasure, the Organ Pipe National Monument. And so in Organ Pipe National Monument, which is a designated wilderness in the United States, this is a place where motor vehicles are not allowed. But because of the Secure Fence Act of 2006, a wall was constructed that needs to be patrolled by large vehicles, four-wheel drives, that drag tires behind the vehicles to denude the landscape and so that you have a kind of a clean tabula rasa landscape next to the wall. So when the wall was constructed there, it also began to direct people in very particular ways through that wilderness, and it increased the amount of trails and ruts created by all-terrain vehicles and people walking, but also Border Patrol agents who were going off-road to chase people. So there became an enormous amount of vehicular traffic through a very sensitive landscape that is designated as one of the most pristine landscapes that we have in the United States, the most protected landscapes of wilderness. And so herein lies the irony behind the drawing that I produced, the cactus wall, which is that we should dismantle that wall and invest instead in an intensive restoration of that desert landscape, of this landscape where very rare forms of cactus grow. And so what the drawing sort of evokes is a wall that's been constructed of cactus in place of where the wall existed previously. And so this again, is evocative of many kinds of meanings. When you see the wall of cactus, you might think, oh, well, this is a proposition for a natural wall that would prevent people from crossing. And there again is the irony, because it's really a proposition for restoring a landscape. But if you restored it in the places where an extreme kind of denuding of the landscape took place, you would then propose an extreme kind of restoration of that landscape, which would be a wilderness that's very difficult to cross. And so, again, it's not suggesting there should be a cactus wall that stops people. It's suggesting we need to restore this landscape that's been destroyed by the construction of the wall and the patrolling of this landscape where motor vehicles shouldn't be.
To get a better sense of your wanting to draw people together, you took inspiration from the Haskell Free Library and Opera House, which sits on the border of Vermont and Quebec. What would that look like on the Mexican-American border, something that you call the library wall?
Yes, well, we created a drawing that of a binational library that would be located in Nogales, Arizona, and Nogales, Mexico. And that construction of the library would span the border, but the wall would be left in place in that case, where the wall then became a bookshelf, a very humble bookshelf where books can be stacked and that knowledge could be shared through the wall. So this would be a binational library that people could visit on both sides, but really the dismantling in this case is this conceptual dismantling where suddenly the wall is this bookshelf. And what I hope these kinds of I hope the conversations that come out of these series of drawings and speculations result in is to suggest that, yes, this is a very kind of simple line in the sand that has been fortified and militarized, but that also it's very easy to broach that line in the sand in very simple ways. And again, we've seen this done many times. Friendship Park is another example where we're inspired by people coming together, having picnics through the wall, having binational yoga classes, playing volleyball across the wall. So when millions of dollars are meant to keep people apart in a way, we're seeing the wall serving as a device that's bringing people together in really remarkable ways.
Well, this is a wonderful book, Border Wall as Architecture, and in it, Ronald Real and others exploring how architects can undermine the wall, not just structurally, but conceptually. Give us one more example. I'm just curious. The teeter-totter wall.
The teeter-totter wall is a drawing that we did very early on, and it is very simple. It's a drawing of a wall that already exists. So all of the drawings of these speculations are built upon drawings that we created by taking the actual plans from the Army Corps of Engineers and reproducing those walls, but then making subtle transformations. And in this case, the simple transformation is to insert a teeter-totter through that wall so that people on both sides can participate in the simple act of riding a seesaw. Now, what's we hope is more provocative in terms of the meaning of that is that really it suggests that there's this fulcrum that exists between these two countries, and it's on this border where this fulcrum exists. And we rely on each other within each country. We rely on Mexico, and Mexico relies on us. And we are neighbors, and we can feel the consequences of those relationships, just as if we were on a teeter-totter together. And so when we think about our national economy and the production of goods, the farming and agriculture, about food and commerce, and all these issues that stitches us together, and that's not including the families and the histories of people that have existed along that border for centuries, this teeter-totter wall really is the synthesis of these ideas that suggest that we really that depend on each other, and the actions on one side are felt on the other.
Do you feel that what you're talking about today, promoting more social, economic, ecological development on both sides of the border, is that more likely to be the outcome over time once we get through this very contentious period, as opposed to the wall design that the president has talked about?
Well, I can only be optimistic that that would be the case, but I think for the most part, we have, and I say we as citizens of both countries, we have shared ideals and values, and that ultimately we seek the common public good over profits or over fear, and so I certainly think and hope that this is the direction that we're headed.
When we look back in your book, Franklin Delano Roosevelt laid out a course for U.S.-Mexico relations at the onset of World War II with a vision of hemispheric security, not beholden to a limited view of border fortification. And let me just read this and get your reaction as we close. Roosevelt said, "What I seek to convey is the historic truth that the United States as a nation has at all times maintained opposition, clear, definite opposition to any attempt to lock us in behind an ancient Chinese wall." Can we get that message out to more people that that has been our thinking over time?
Well, I believe so. You know, the wall is, in its current manifestation, is a very anachronistic structure. It will have similar responses on the other side. So we've seen that happen already, where this very, I'll call it dumb wall, is constructed, and there are very simple ways to cross it, and people are launching drugs across with catapults, or simply placing ramps over it and driving over it. I think we if we recognize how ridiculous this structure is, then we might seek more sophisticated ways to engage our neighbors, and I don't think those have to be responses that are created of fear or structures that are created of fear or violence. Again, I think those could be structures that allow us to think about the symbiotic relationship we have with our neighbor in the 21st century.
Some of the things, by the way, that you were talking about that have been done over the 700 miles already, given the nature of the political discourse in America, have neighbors across those walls and those various forms of building a construct between the nations, have they begun to get together, some of those on one side or the other, to figure out again creatively, perhaps not as creatively as you have designed in the book, but have they been trying to form more of an association now that there seems to be this us against them mentality?
Yes, absolutely. I don't think there's an. I actually don't think there's an us against them mentality on the border. I think there's a we mentality on the border. And so, for example, in my book, I did a drawing of a binational theater with people sitting on both sides, mm-hmm. and the stage existing on both sides. And so, performances would take place on both sides, or a projection would take place right in the middle. And it sort of unites people on both sides, so audiences are sitting right next to each other, but there's a barrier. That actually took place just a couple of weeks ago in Douglas, Arizona, in Agua Prieta, Mexico. So the community came together through an arts organization and had binational performances with seats right alongside the border. So This is already happening throughout the country along the border, where arts organizations and activists are coming together on both sides to again celebrate what is an us identity, a we identity, and not this side and that side.
All right. Well, listen, I can't thank you enough for coming by today and also sharing this wonderful book with all of us to open up our minds to a new way to think about this border wall. Border wall as architecture, and, of course, trying to tear down some of the differences and unite us in a totally different fashion than the conversation has focused on in the recent period here in America. Ronald Rael, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Larry.
If you like this episode, please leave us a kind rating or review. I'm on my hands and knees. Please do it on iTunes, because your review is really critical for us to continue providing this podcast. And John, I know that iTunes looks at this. They want to make certain that we have some ranking, some visibility, and that we're getting some traffic, and then they give you better positioning.
Absolutely. And this way, it'll put us in the forefront so you can find us much easier on your iPhone or Android, whatever you may be using.
And they may even send you out an alert. So please, if you can, don't miss a single episode of America Trends Podcast. And, John, they can subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher.com.
And also subscribe on our website.
Oh, absolutely.
We send out a little blurb, and we can also take your emails there at newsletter@rifkinradio.com. That's another way to get us.
And we do not sell or share
no
our
spamming,
lists.
No spamming, nothing.
Well, I don't know. Does anybody want our lists? I don't know, but we don't do it.
Good question.
Even if they asked us.
Even
nobody's
if they
asked us. But.
Right.
And when you do subscribe, let us know on Facebook and Twitter. We're getting very active on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle on both platforms, and John, this is really easy, at Trends Podcast. That's it.
That's real easy.
You like that? Did
yeah,
you get that?
I got that.
Okay.
I'm going to have to check it out
quiz.
Now. I'm going to have to tweet it.
We want to thank you, of course, personally for subscribing. And we also would like to get some of your ideas and questions for future episodes of America Trends Podcast. And that's important, too, because we're all over the map. Our interest editorially in the future, John, has no bounds. But we want to know what it is that you'd like to hear from us, if there was a segment that you'd like to see us follow up on, or if there's something in depth that you'd like us to deal with. Please let us know that,
yeah,
too.
We're looking at the future. There's so much we can look at.
Yeah, and the topics that we've dealt with, I mean, we have gotten such incredible guests over the recent period, but they're only going to come to us if they know we've got an engaged and interactive audience.
Absolutely.
So it's really important that you become part of this podcast in so many different ways that we're sharing with you today.
You're absolutely right. We need your support and your help and your reviews.
And your ideas.
And ideas.
Or questions on Facebook and Twitter. And by the way, you can direct message us at Trends Podcast or using the hashtag Trends Podcast. You can also add an email address if you have a public one that you'd like us to give out.
Yeah, good. And you know what? We didn't mention Amazon.
Oh, yes. We have an Amazon store.
Yes.
And so if you go up, you don't have to buy the things that might be highlighted at that particular time. You can buy any book, and there's some benefit that comes back
just
to us.
Just put what you're looking at in the little search engine block there, and it'll take you right to Amazon, and it'll help us out.
Absolutely. And it doesn't really cost you anything more, because they have built that into their pricing structure. So we get a little taste, and you get more programming like this, and you get the item that you were looking for. So it works
absolutely
for all of us.
It's a win-win.
Absolutely. Win-win-win.
Win-win-win.
So for more information on America Trends and for the latest updates on upcoming episodes, be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can find us at Trends Podcast. And again, you can find John and I here in our studio performing as best we can for you.
That's right. And let us out.
What's that?
Let us out.
Let us out. No one is. Hey, listen, thank you so much for joining us today on America Trends. We'll see you next time.
We hope to hear from you soon.
Oh, by the way, we are posting all the time. And we're posting on Tuesdays, and Thursdays.
Good point.
So just be aware, if you're looking for new episodes, they're coming on Tuesdays and Thursdays. When you wake up, before you go out on your jog or your walk and you want to take us with you, we'll be there for you.
Very good.
All right. Have a great day.